on right now, so we have a nice cool a breeze, cool weather, low humidity. I do hope the soldiers in 1777, for both sides, we'll be fair, for both sides had this kind of weather. We know that it was a pleasant day, no references to it being overly hot or humid or anything like that. And they, like I said earlier, they were fighting right this very second on this very field 241 years ago. So, you know, people dying all around us, it's pretty humbling, I think, at least for me anyway, to think about that, you know, to think of that kind of mortality, and to think of how important this field of fighting was. Now, there are lots of battles in the Revolutionary War, lots of skirmishes. Some of them are really important. Some of them are maybe locally important. Some of them, you know, maybe kind of a wash in terms of strategic or tactical value. But the Battle of Freeman's Farm had serious repercussions. Because if you think of history, or military history, like dominoes, you know, one domino falls, the next domino falls, the next thing happens, right? Cause and effect, we call it. The Battle of Freeman's Farm has very serious repercussions, which then play out in the next few weeks following the battle, leading into the second battle. And the second battle leads, of course, ultimately to the first ever British Army surrender in world history. That would be Burgoyne's Army surrender at Saratoga. A British Army had never surrendered before, and it happened because of so many events that led up to it. If we go back before the Battle of Freeman's Farm, certainly there are other events like the Battle of Bennington. Words can't describe how important the Battle of Bennington was to the outcome of this campaign. It was absolutely critical. So if you've ever been to Bennington Battlefield, you can check that site out. It's a great New York State historic site. But here we are at Freeman's Farm on the very moment of the battle being fought. As I said, the battle was 8 hours long. If we look at the beginning phase of the battle, we're looking at about 12 noon, 11:30, somewhere in there. Again, times usually aren't very exact. Different people tell us different times for different things, and it's hard to pin down with accuracy what the timings were. But the battle began right here. Late morning of the 19th of September, 1777. So here's the lead up to the fight that began right here, which started off the Battle of Freeman's Farm. General Burgoyne, he commands an army of about 8,500 officers and men. This British army is marching all the way from Canada, you know, by the use of boats and, of course, shoes. They're marching, they're using the rivers and lakes to transport themselves, and they're looking to get to Albany. That's their destination point, not but 40 miles south of us. You can see how far they've gone. They've started off in June of 1777, all the way from Canada, hundreds of miles to the north of us, and they got this close. They are totally ready to go. They got all their baggage ready. They got all of their provisions ready to sustain their army, and they are gunning for Albany. This is the last-ditch effort. They're looking to ramrod right through any American defenses. As for those American defenses, the American army is commanded by Major General Horatio Gates. He's a Virginian, and he's up here commanding the Northern Army, as it's called. The Northern Army at the time of the battles of Saratoga is located at Bemis's Heights. Bemis's Heights is at stop 3 on our tour road. Bemis's Heights, that high ground that overlooks the valley below and the river below. And Horatio Gates commands about 8,100 officers and men, most of whom are Continental soldiers. You could call them professional soldiers, insofar as that they are in the army for 3 years or the duration of the war. They're not just in it for a couple weeks like a militia soldier might be, although sometimes militia soldiers have to serve for months on end before they get to go home. So you have 22 battalions of Continental troops from New York and Massachusetts, New Hampshire. There is a battalion of riflemen, 400 guys from Virginia and Pennsylvania. They got rifles. They can shoot with greater distance and with far more accuracy than any other soldiers in that Northern Army can. And there's an entire corps of artillery, 22 guns, manning the defenses that the Americans have at Bemis's Heights and the surrounding high ground. Horatio Gates also has five battalions of militia, Three of them are from New York. Two of them are from Connecticut, of all places. Connecticut. But Connecticut militia are here, almost in the same numbers as New York militia. Gotta wonder, where's the New York militia? We'll talk about that later. But militia, got some. Most of the army is composed of Continental troops. They're strongly entrenched at Bemis's Heights, as I said. And the engineering genius behind those defenses is the same guy who the Twin Bridges is named after. Anybody know?
Thaddeus Kosciusko.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Thaddeus Kosciusko. Yeah. The Twin Bridges, right? On the I-87, the Northway, as we locals call it. Indeed, it is the Thaddeus Kosciusko Bridge, and it's named after this Polish hero who came from Poland, studied in Poland, studied in France, and now he volunteered his services to the United States, trying to gain independence for the United States. He wanted to help us out. And there were other people in the American army throughout the war that were from Europe who tried to do the same thing. Famously, Baron Steuben, for example, he tried to help us out as well and did a great job too. He wasn't here, but Kosciusko was. So on the British side, imagine it's the 17th of September, 2 days before that first battle of Saratoga, the one fought right here. The British are located about a mile and a half north of us at a place called Swords' House, and it was the home of Mary and Thomas Swords. They were loyalists, so I can imagine Mary, who was the only one living there at the time, her husband and her sons were gone. But she was in her house. I can imagine that she was happy to have her house used as Burgoyne's headquarters because she's an American who's a loyalist. She's on the British side. She sees Burgoyne's army as saviors. You know, she's not all for this rebellion, this old new United States thing. She doesn't want any part of it. She and some other local people, like the people who lived here on this very farm, were in favor of restoring what they called, and I quote, legal government. They saw the Americans who were in rebellion as the usurpers. They're the ones that are committing acts of violence and illegal things. They need to be brought to justice. They need to be put in jail. They need to be summarily crushed. And so the loyalists, or royalists as they're also called, like Mary Swords, are happy that the British are finally here to save the day against these rebel oppressors. That's what they're thinking. So General Burgoyne, his army is up where the National Cemetery is today, up in that area. They're up there. And like I said, he has about 8,500 officers and men. He's there for the 17th of September and the 18th of September. And he's, by that time, received enough intelligence and information about the disposition of American defenses down at Bemis's Heights. So he has a general idea of the size of the American army and the location of the defenses. He doesn't have a map to it so much, but he has a general idea. How does he know that? Well, he has people that are going out on little scouting missions, spy missions, and dare I say, deserters from the Northern Army coming to Burgoyne, giving him information. Because so far in the campaign, Bennington aside, the British have won pretty much everything. The Battle of Hubbardton, the Battle of Fort Anne, the fight at Skeensboro, the capture of Fort Ticonderoga and Fort Independence. Can anything stop this behemoth that is Burgoyne's army? Sure, Bennington was a great success, but you know, well, a bunch of Germans and loyalists, so many of them who didn't even have guns. So, you know, that's the idea that a lot of Americans who are a little, some of them are a little scared, thinking, oh my gosh, here's the real army now. We're doomed. We got to desert. So some Americans do desert. I can assure you that if you're thinking, well, that's kind of a downer, don't worry, it will be in reverse just soon after the first battle of Saratoga. All desertions go the other way after that battle. So after the intelligence has been received, it's now the morning of the 19th of September. General Burgoyne's army packs up all the tents, all the camp equipage on baggage carts and wagons. All of the soldiers get fully kitted up with 100 rounds of ammunition, and they have knapsacks with all of their personal worldly possessions, their necessaries, and the ammunition that does not fit in their cartridge pouches, most of which carry anywhere from 28 to 36 rounds of ammunition. So they divide the army up into three separate columns. The column that is to the west of us, you can't really see it too well here, but the visitor center is located about 3/4 of a mile through the open space there. There, you know, the visitor center's on a hill. There's a road to the east of that hill. There was a road there, and that's where Simon Fraser is marching his advanced corps. The advanced corps column consists of over 2,000 troops, and these are the elite soldiers of General Burgoyne's army. This is where the British Grenadiers are, some of the bigger, stronger, more veteran soldiers. The British Light Infantry, these are going to be more veteran soldiers who are also smaller, light, and quick on their feet. They're going to have the 24th Regiment of Foot, which is probably the best trained regiment that General Burgoyne has, a British regiment that he has in his army. He also has all of the Haudenosaunee warriors. These are the Mohawk warriors. These are men from Fort Hunter, which is just outside of Amsterdam today. They've traveled 50 miles to seek out Burgoyne, because they're refugees. Their home at Fort Hunter was threatened by American revolutionaries and their Oneida allies. So these Haudenosaunee Mohawk warriors and women and elders and children, they traveled to join Burgoyne's army seeking protection. Well, the fighting men of those refugees, they're over there with Fraser's advanced corps. He's also got an entire company of the Royal Regiment of Artillery. He's got four of those. Those are light three-pounders. He's got two of those. Those are Royal Howitzers. And he's got four light six-pounders, which I wish I could point to one. But imagine a gun that's about twice as big as that one there. So he's got 10 pieces of artillery all told. Behind them are the elite German soldiers. These guys are the German grenadiers. You know, with the tall caps, with the metal fronts, and the mustaches. They like mustaches. They also have the German light infantry, similar to the British light infantry, usually smaller, younger guys who are able to run fast. Interestingly enough, this reserve corps, these German elite soldiers with Fraser, they have Jaeger with them. Does anybody know what Jaeger means?
Hunter.
Yeah, hunter, that's right, yeah. A Jägermeister, right? Master hunter. So, yeah. Jaeger, that's right, these guys have rifles. Remember I mentioned the Americans have rifles? Mind you, it's just 400 riflemen out of an army of about 8,100, but still they got 400 riflemen from Virginia and Pennsylvania. The Jaeger amount to about 50. So, Burgoyne doesn't have many riflemen. He's got 50 of them, but, you know, they know what rifling is, they understand rifling, and they know how effective rifles can be, but if you compare the 50 to the 400, you know, you can see who's outmatched. So that's the elite Western column under the command of Simon Fraser. The column that is going to drive right through here at Freeman's Farm consists of four plain old British regiments of foot, the 9th, the 20th, the 21st, and the 62nd regiments of foot. Each regiment has about 400 officers and men each. They also have a detachment of Royal Artillery consisting of four of those six-pounders that I can't point out because there's not one in viewing distance, but about twice as big as that gun there. If you've been in the visitor center recently, that cannon that's on the carriage that we have near the visitor center doors, that's actually not just a light six-pounder, but one from Burgoyne's army. Could have been one of them that was with the center column. We don't know, but it was definitely here. But that's a light six-pounder. That's the size we're talking about. General Burgoyne himself is with the center column. That becomes key when we talk about the battle itself. Then way down by the river, the Hudson River, a good mile and a quarter, mile and a half to the east of us, you have the rest of General Burgoyne's army. This consists of most of the German common regiments, the Regiment Speck, the Regiment von Reitz, the Regiment von Riedesel. You have also the remnants of the Dragoon Regiment. You've heard of those guys in the Battle of Bennington, Dragoons, but they don't have horses, but they have the big cavalry sabers, but they're on foot, but they're trained to fight with muskets and bayonets, but they don't do too well at Bennington. They're over there. The remnants of that unit are over there. They also have the hospital, the provisions, all of the non-combatants, the Royal Navy's over there. Royal Navy, I know, right? It's not exactly the Seven Seas, but the Hudson River is a great highway to move along all of your provisions and hospital supplies and etc. So they have lots and lots of scows and bateaux in the Hudson River being moved along by Royal Navy personnel as well as, like I said, non-combatant royalists. refugees are down there. People who don't want to have anything to do with this revolution, they're glad Burgoyne is here to save the day, so they're there. And all of the soldiers' wives and children, they're down by the river too, separated from their men, because these columns, these two columns, the one to the west and the one coming through here, these are the columns that are going to go into combat. And the expectation is on the 19th of September that they're going to go into combat. So they're not going to be surprised that they're going to go into a fight. They're ready for it. That's the key. They're ready to go into a fight. The whole column is backed up by the train of artillery, all the spare artillery with Burgoyne's army is over there by the river. And the last regiment keeping up the rear guard is his single Hessian regiment called the Regiment Erbprinz. And that's an actual proper Hessian regiment. So there were Hessians here at Saratoga, in fact. So once the columns have been positioned, cannons go off to signal that everybody's ready so they can move simultaneously. The worst thing would have been if they start moving separately and then it would have been a mess. No, they want this to be timed simultaneously, this movement. So all three columns begin to move. The center column, though, is the one that's going to have the hardest time of it because they have to go through the Great Ravine. And as they're getting through the Great Ravine, American patrols, sentinels in the woods, begin skirmishing with them. And the British skirmish back. The sentinels are drawn back late morning of the 19th of September. And finally, word is getting back to the American camp, a good mile and a half south of us, that the British are on the move. They've packed up camp. They're on their way. And reports are that they're all coming this direction. The Americans don't know anything about that column. They don't know anything about that column. But thanks to the skirmishing going on in the Great Ravine, they know about this column. Benedict Arnold, who is the de facto second in command of the army, convinces Horatio Gates, says, "Hey, Gates, you know what? The British are on the move. We expected this. We knew this was going to happen. It was inevitable. Allow me to attack the British." Benedict Arnold, a name you've heard of before, certainly. You probably read about Benedict Arnold. You know that he's a very aggressive guy. He loves bringing the battle to the enemy, even when he doesn't have the necessary advantage to win a battle. He doesn't care. This guy is fearless. This guy is very, very audacious, very, very aggressive. He wants to move out and attack. Now, he's thinking, and this is kind of smart, right? He's thinking that if he can bring the battle to the British, even if the Americans lose the battle, they still have their defenses that the British have to get through. So it's better than allowing the British to attack the defenses outright, where if the British plow through the defenses, then the Americans are done. Now, Gates thinks about it, and they kind of debate over the efficacy of the plan. And finally, Gates agrees and said, "You know what, Arnold, tell you what, you can send out the Corps of Riflemen, all 400 of them, under Daniel Morgan's command, Colonel Daniel Morgan of Virginia. You can also send out the New England Light Infantry Battalion, commanded by Major Henry Dearborn. These two units together number about 700 officers and men, and with them, you can slow the British advance up. You can bloody the British up so much so that by the time they get to attack us, they will have been spent. So many of the officers, so many of the artillerymen, the horses pulling the artillery, that's key, shoot the horses, right? The artillery can't move unless you've got guys pulling and pushing, and that's not very efficient if you're moving to position yourself to attack defenses. So the Americans are thinking, you know, Gates and Arnold are thinking, this is a great idea. And Gates then says, "You may support them if necessary, but let's try to keep it to this attack alone." And so Arnold says, "All right, let's do it." So out comes Colonel Daniel Morgan, followed by Dearborn. Colonel Morgan goes first with his riflemen. They're very quick at feet, and they are moving in a very, very long column of twos, you know, like a column of twos. They come right out of that tree line because they have been informed that the British are down in the Great Ravine, coming in this direction, edging in this direction. And so the column comes through, opens up onto the Freeman Farm field here, and then they're going to start to deploy themselves in various locations. The advanced company of Morgan's Rifle Corps, commanded by Captain Swearingen, is going to come right over here to this spot. Now, if we pause for a second, let me explain to you exactly what Freeman's Farm pretty much looked like, as far as we can tell, at the time of the battles of Saratoga. First of all, John and Ethelana Freeman had about 8 children. they leased their land from a guy named Philip Schuyler, the same General Philip Schuyler, who we know and love. But I can tell you that the love between them was not mutual because the Freemans were royalists. They were on the British side. They wanted nothing to do with the revolution. And in fact, they hated the idea so much that they had left. Battles of Saratoga. So this property had been abandoned by the Freemans months beforehand. In fact, the Freemans were with General Burgoyne's army, no doubt hoping to reclaim their farm, to swipe away all the rebel committees of safety and get rid of all those people that have been suppressing them all of these long months. But the Freeman farm, a house, the log cabin was located right here. There was a barn located to the south of here. You see all those pink flags over there? That's about where the barn was located. There was a shed, a wooden shed, on the southern side of the field. The field that you see now, the open field, approximates the way it was in 1777. I can tell you that there were a lot more trees in this area here. It was more forested here. The reason why it's cleared is because after the first battle was fought, the British cut down a lot of trees throughout this field. And we have the field forest configuration approximate to the time of the second battle of Saratoga, not the first. So we have to pretend a little bit. So imagine this was covered in wood. Then over here, there was more woods down there as well. You see how there's this kind of inlet into the wood line? Imagine that's filled with trees. Down there is where the Freemans had their primary field of cultivation. That's where they were growing most of their crops. The property was more or less fenced in by a rather complicated system, according to the maps, of wooden rail fences, split rail fences. You've seen them probably in real life or in pictures. So Morgan's riflemen, they're starting to spread out throughout the field. Swearingen's guys get up here. The major of the Rifle Corps, Joseph Morris, he's on horseback. Apparently, he's directing Swearingen where to go. And hardly, a moment after they had arrived, out of the wood line comes a wall of redcoats. 100 British redcoat soldiers. These are the picket, or if you will, screening force of the center column. You don't want to have all of your troops just jump out of the woods into something you don't know what's going on. You want to have a screening force to make sure everything's safe, and then you bring everybody else on to the main field. Well, as soon as this British picket comes out of the wood line, Swearingen's guys got their rifles, boy. They couldn't ask for better targets. So they start shooting at their red-coated people coming out of at them from the woods. And the redcoats, they're just shot down. Most of them are killed or wounded. The commander of that picket, Major Forbes, he's wounded as well. The survivors are going to absolutely panic and run to the safety of the wood line. Now, Swearingen's guys are thinking, whoa, we got them on the run. Let's go get them. This is exciting. So they go chase them down. Bad move. Because Fraser, General Fraser, who is now operating in that big field over there, you see, the big field with the trees, a couple trees here and there, that's where Fraser was operating. Now remember, this is woods right here, so it wasn't an exact clear line of sight, but you can hear pretty well that there's shooting going on. Fraser detached two companies, about 60 or so officers, 120 or so officers and men of the 24th Regiment of Foot, and one of those, a light three-pounder, a little cannon. So they move immediately to check out to see what was going on, and they're able to, with some Indians that were with them, outflank Morgan's riflemen that had overextended themselves. Swearingen's guys are surprised by this attack. They tumble out of the woods panicking because they've just been hit hard. Major Joseph Morris, the rifle major. His horse, according to him, kicked up and ran off, took off with him. He couldn't control the horse. Swearingen was captured, the captain of riflemen. He was captured, and some of his men, of course, were killed and captured as well. The riflemen, though, as they start running out of here, creates an entire panic throughout the entire rifle corps. The entire rifle corps folds back with the redcoats bringing up the light three-pounder. They're not pursuing too far because they would have overextended themselves, but the riflemen panic and flee for the southern side of the field. But beyond that, one American officer says that he saw Morgan and his riflemen trying to get the battalion back together half a mile south of that tree line, way in the distance. So they were really seriously panicked by this outflanking maneuver, this attack that they did not expect. So you see, both sides got a little bested with some surprise moves. But this does prove one thing. If there's going to be a battle on the 19th of September, it's going to happen here. Both sides have made contact. This is often how it happens, right? You don't know where the enemy is. You feel each other out, and then, you know, surprise, surprise, outflank, maneuver, fall back, reconfigure things, and now is going to come the battle proper. So General Burgoyne, early afternoon, orders out his four British regiments, the 9th Regiment over there, the 21st Regiment over here, the 62nd Regiment over here, the 20th Regiment down there, arrayed in line of battle. Now, remember I said how they had all of this camp equipage on them, their knapsacks with all of their heavy stuff? I didn't mention they have food bags called haversacks full of 4 days' worth of rations. That's 12 pounds of food on their person. That's a lot, 12 pounds, you know? So that's heavier than a musket, in fact. So what do? Are they going to go into battle with all that stuff? No, they're not stupid. You know, movies might make them to be stupid, or paintings might show them to be stupid, doing stupid things, but often that's not the reality of the case. So what these guys did was they took off their knapsacks, they took off their haversacks, they removed all of this heavy stuff. So now they get back into line, and they're ready to go into battle. They want to go into battle. They've been waiting for this. For most of these troops, they had not fought in battle yet this entire campaign. I mean, it's September 19th, and for most of them, they hadn't fought in a battle yet this entire campaign. And actually, beyond that, for most of them, they have not fought in a battle their entire lives. I'm not kidding. Their entire lives, for most of them. But for almost all of them, not this campaign. As for the soldiers that have fought so far in the campaign, the 9th Regiment of Foot, they fought in the Battle of Fort Anne, which had been fought in early July of 1777. General Burgoyne, as soon as he put them out into the field, ordered them back as a reserve that was never deployed during the entire battle. That's why the 9th Regiment suffered no casualties, except the casualties sustained in the piquet when Swearingen's riflemen shot them down. So the 9th Regiment of Foot is put behind the wood line on a road, which is where the Wilkinson Trail is, the current Wilkinson Trail. They're right on that road. So he's got three regiments, two pair of those light six-pounders manned by Royal Artillerymen, and they're ready to go into battle. They can't wait. What about the Americans? Now, remember the riflemen had scattered. They're a half mile south of that far tree line. There are no Americans to be seen except Dearborn's Light Infantry. Major Henry Dearborn's Corps of Light Infantry, about 300 officers and men, divided up into five companies. They had followed Morgan's riflemen, but they were too slow, ironically, being light infantry, they were too slow in getting to the field of action to save Morgan. So what Dearborn smartly did was he positioned his troops on that low-rising hill. You see to the south of us, slightly to the west, there's this low-rising hill with these white posts with red tops. It's exposed right now, but on the 19th of September, it was wooded. So that's where Dearborn puts his 300 guys, and they're facing this way because that's where the British are. They see the British see them. Now, there's a bit of a lull at this point. We don't know how long it took. The British want to fight, but they want the Americans to come out onto the open field to fight them. The Americans, you know, I don't know if they want to fight, can't say that, but they definitely don't want the British to pass them. They will fight, of course, to prevent the British from passing them, but they don't really want to go out in the open and fight the British, especially since the British outnumber them, you know, almost 4-1. So they're going to stay put. And the British stay put, waiting for more Americans to come at them. Nothing happens. So General Burgoyne or General Hamilton, who's technically in command of the center column, but when the boss is around, you know, who cares what the divisional commander thinks, you know? So eventually they order the center regiment, the 62nd Regiment, afoot to advance with 400 guys against Dearborn's 300 guys. This is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 19th of September. As the 62nd Regiment is marching toward Dearborn, crashing out of the woods comes Colonel Joseph Silly and his 1st New Hampshire Regiment. I cannot tell you if this was planned, if they were just waiting, because the British probably couldn't see them because of the hills and such, or if it just was serendipity and they just happened to come out of the woods at that very time. We don't know. Either way, Joseph Silly and his 1st New Hampshire Regiment come out of the woods, array in line of battle, and then start shooting at the 62nd Regiment, which of course turns to react, and there's a firefight between these two battalions of equal strength. According to one of the journalists, who was a lieutenant with Silly's battalion, he says that after 20 minutes fighting, they had received so many casualties in the 1st New Hampshire Regiment that they had to retreat after 20 minutes fighting. So they have to turn around and retreat back through the woods. Henry Dearborn in his journal says that he saw Silly retreating. He tried to come up and help him, but he couldn't make it in time. Apparently it just didn't work out for him. So as Colonel Silly is marching through the woods back to camp, he encounters reinforcements coming up to help him out. This is Alexander Scammell. He's colonel of the 3rd New Hampshire Regiment with more reinforcements. And of course they talk, Silly and Scammell, and Silly decides to make a U-turn and come back to Freeman's Farm. And Scammell tells Silly, hey, you know what? There's Connecticut militia following me too under the command of Colonel Thaddeus Cook. So there's even more reinforcements thanks to Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold is the guy that is sending in these reinforcements. Do we remember earlier in the action when Gates allowed him to send out the riflemen and light infantry and you may support them if necessary? I think Arnold found it necessary. So at this time, what we can do is we can travel a bit down toward the southern side of the field, and we can see where some of this battle action was taking place during most of the afternoon of the 19th of September, exactly 241 years ago today.
So it's now mid-afternoon of the 19th?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah, it's about 3:30 by the time this is happening. I'll show you where they...
What exactly were they doing? Were they riflemen, or...?
Oh, no, they're militia soldiers. They have regulars who report muskets. I'll be talking about them. In fact, there's a monument to one of their captains who was mortally wounded. It doesn't say on the monument,
Zebulon.
Yeah, that's right. You know him.
Yeah, I'm Brian Bidwell.
Oh, you are? No way.
Yeah. Not, so a cool. not a direct descendant, but my great-grandfather's nephew.
Wow. Neat.
Yeah. He was from Hartford, Connecticut.
Yes, yes, yes. You know about Zebulon Bidwell, then?
Sure.
Were these troops moving? Oh, sorry. Did they have guns, drums and things like that?
Yeah, both sides had drums, yeah. And some pipes. Yeah, so Zebulon Bidwell, he was one of the 8 captains in Colonel Paddy Cook's militia. And what ends up happening, and we know this because his widow files a pension, after the war, she's...
Oh,
okay, yeah. So she writes a pension saying that, from all accounts she's heard, that her husband, Zebulon, had been killed in battle of Freeman's Farm, which is true. In fact, he was mortally wounded. But he had been either shot, different accounts, either shot in the leg, below the knee, by an enemy musket ball, or a cannonball took the bottom of his leg off. He was... they tried to amputate. And it failed. He died. He bled out. So he was mortally wounded. But the monument to him on this hilltop is positioned pretty close to where it theoretically happened.
The way he came out of the woods.
Oh, yeah.
What you were saying.
Yeah, I'll show you. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Connecticut militia here were really special because when it comes down to it, I'll mention it more later. If you look at the casualties of the many American regiments that fought in the battle, Cook's battalion suffered the second highest casualties of any American unit.
Really?
Only second to the 1st New Hampshire Regiment.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They were really hit hard. They lost about 1/8 of their strength, killed, captured, wounded, yeah.
And they were battle veterans, too. They had seen battle in Virginia. At least Cook's regiment with Sophie Longstreth was
These are true
Cornwallis. Oh,
that's later in the war.
Later.
Yeah. Oh, I see. You're talking about New Jersey, I think.
Yeah. The New Jersey campaigning in 76, late 76, with Lord Cornwallis.
Yeah, well, that part of it was where my direct descendant, who was the cousin of Zebulon, was actually at that battle.
Yeah.
They come up here with Zebulon.
Sure, yeah. Trenton, Princeton. Yeah, a lot of those guys.
So not Virginia, but
New Jersey. Yeah, a lot of those guys had officers and men had indeed been on other campaigns and served in other battles before. Absolutely, yes.
Had von Storben gotten to these guys yet in terms of drilling and formations and things like
that? You know, it's kind of funny.
He used them in Montclair quite a bit. Training in the Valley Forge.
Sure. So what you have here is this American Army, just like the entire American Army, the Continental Army, and every state militia, at least that was here. I don't know about the training regimens of state militias in the South, but I can tell you in New England and in New York, from, you know, where all the militia came from, they were all using the British Manual of Arms.
Oh, they were?
Okay. Oh, yeah. So the basic drill that the British were using was the same drill that the Americans were using. And as you know, Steuben comes into play at the Forge and changes much of the details. Yeah, exactly. He simplified it. Yeah. Smart. Very smart to do that.
So were these guys marching in columns of two, columns of four?
It depends.
Did that change when they went through the woods?
It totally depends on the unit you're talking about. So when Morgan and his riflemen... That's a great place to stop right there. Awesome. Thank you. So when Morgan's rifle corps are marching, they're in a column of twos.
Okay.
So they're long, drawn out, you know, about 200 guys per file. So they're a very long column. But that is not so typical of the way that forces would move. But it really depends on where you're moving through. I mean, they had to go through a path in the woods, you know, so yeah, that's the best way to do it. And you're not really afraid that the enemy's going to be around you because they're not so, you know, they're Morgan's guys are south of Freeman's Farm, and the British are north of Freeman's Farm. They know that the British aren't anywhere around, so they're just trying to get there as fast as possible. And that's the way they thought that would be the best way to do it.
Can we assume that Morgan and Dearborn were very close to Arnold because they would have helped with him on the trip to Quebec?
Yeah.
Dearborn almost died.
So we went there.
Oh yeah. I'm with you.
So imagine they were close.
I think so.
Yeah.
And they were here. You know, Benedict Arnold's headquarters was in the red painted Nielsen House. Morgan and Dearborn are camped right north of there. At the time, they were under his direct command. I think you're right. Yeah. Sure. So, what you have here is the 62nd Regiment, the 1st New Hampshire Regiment had fought here. The 1st New Hampshire Regiment, remember, retreated. Then they return with the reinforcements, the 3rd New Hampshire Regiment, and then Colonel Thaddeus Cook's Battalion of Connecticut Militia, which deploys over there. So you have the militia, then you have the 3rd New Hampshire Regiment, then the 1st New Hampshire Regiment. Well, of course, the British, now they're outgunned, so they bring up the 21st Regiment of Foot. Then they bring up cannons. Now, this is something the Americans do not have on the field of battle. They don't have cannons. They have cannons back in camp, defending their fortified walls, but they don't have any cannons brought to the field at any time during the battle. So the British bring up both pair of their light six-pounders. There's one there. You see it with the red-painted boxes, box tops? That's a light six-pounder. So imagine two pair of those things shooting at the Americans. Now, the British are shooting solid shots, which are just solid iron cannonballs, and they're shooting something called case shot. They only have the two kinds of projectiles they can use in Burgoyne's army. Solid shot and case shot. No grape, no canister. Case shot is something that is, imagine like a tin tube full of iron balls, about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. And you shoot that thing and it sprays at the enemy. It doesn't go as far as a cannonball will, but the dispersion of death is far greater, as you can imagine. So it's like for those of you who are into artillery, it's like a cross between
King about
grape shot and canister.
So that's what they're shooting at the Americans. Now, the Americans aren't stupid, right? They'll be in the wood line. They see the artillery being brought up, they go into the wood line. And according to one American officer, the artillery fire from the British guns shooting at the Americans in the woods did, and I quote, little more than to take the limbs from trees. That's the kind of damage that they did, which is pretty much nothing. The British see that happening and they're thinking, okay, well, the artillery isn't being that effective. It's keeping them off the field of battle, which is good, but that means we have to go at them with the bayonet in the woods or with musket fire in the woods. So the British, little known fact, have been trained at wood fighting. The Americans were really clever at fighting in the woods, using trees for cover, you know, while you're shooting down at your enemy out in the open field. But the British have been trained to do this too. This is not something that the British have been trained to do because they do this in Europe, no. This is not part of the manual exercise, no. But this is an adaptation that the British have employed during the Revolutionary War, since the year 1776, when they started to train on what they called treeing. That's the thing. Treeing, they call it. So the Italians, the British, are close enough, they're advancing toward the trees, the order to tree is given, and immediately the soldiers disperse to the tree line, looking for the trees in front of them, and they pair up with firing partners, and they start shooting into the woods at the Americans. Now the Americans are going to fall back deeper into the wood line. The British are going to advance deeper into the woods. So you got two regiments, the 21st Regiment and the 62nd Regiment, doing this, and you got three American regiments, the 3rd New Hampshire, the 1st New Hampshire, and Cook's Battalion of Connecticut Militia, drawing back through the woods. And as the Americans are drawing back, the British are drawing in deeper and deeper in the woods. Three American regiments versus two British regiments. As you get deeper, pulled back into the woods, the British get a little broken up because they don't have as many troops as the Americans do. The force-to-space ratio, it's called, is on the side of the Americans. The Americans have the advantage of this force-to-space ratio because the Americans have more troops. Thank you, Benedict Arnold. So the Americans then get the opportunity to turn the tide. So they will then rush forward at the British, who have overextended themselves. The British will come tumbling out of the woods because they're being overwhelmed because there's so many more Americans in the woods than there are British soldiers, because there's just two British regiments doing this. So the British come tumbling out of the woods. Well, they got their cannons. The cannons aren't going in the woods. The cannons have been staying, you know, sitting right here. And once you see the British coming out of the woods, they get out of the way. The cannons then start shooting into the woods. The Americans aren't going to go out in the open because why? The cannons are there. Remember, whose job is it to win this battle, to break through and get to Albany, to break through the American lines of defense? It's the British job. The Americans have to do nothing but prevent the British from surpassing them. That's it. They don't have to beat the British in battle. They just have to make sure that the British don't pass them by. So what's the point of risking your lives to the death of cannon shot out here in the opening? There's no point to it. Very clever, right? Now the British realize they got to break through, and the Americans are using the tree lines for cover, and the cannons aren't any good shooting into the woods so much, so they got to try it again. And they go into the woods again, and the same thing happens. We don't know how many times it happens exactly, but we know it happens a few times where the British go into the woods, the Americans beat them out of the woods. Benedict Arnold sends more reinforcements to the line. The 2nd New Hampshire Regiment comes up. And if you were wondering, well, if they're numbered 1, 2, 3, why'd they send in the 1st and then the 3rd? Why didn't they send in the 2nd, you know? Just a little detail. But the 2nd New Hampshire Regiment is the regiment that got chewed up at the Battle of Hubbardton. Very badly, so badly that they were kind of a skeletal regiment. But Benedict Arnold still sent them into the battle because, you know, a few hundred troops is better than none. So they send in the 2nd New Hampshire Regiment to even strengthen that force-to-space ratio even better. Most of the Americans have bayonets because most of the Americans fighting in this battle have French muskets with bayonets, most of them, that have been surplused to them from France. This is before the French alliance. The French are not formally our allies yet, but the French government is very supportive of this idea of a war between the British colonies and Great Britain itself. They're mortal enemies, right? So what the French decided to do in early 1777 is send secretive shipments of supplies, war material, things like cannons, cannonballs, cannon carriages, blankets, other kinds of clothing, entrenching tools, gunpowder, money, tents, of course, muskets and bayonets, too. So the New Hampshire troops that are fighting this battle, they all have French muskets, most of which have their bayonets still on them. Most of them didn't lose them yet. So they got their bayonets, they got their muskets, so they can do bayonet charges. And with the overwhelming numbers in the woods, the Americans have the advantage. The British are once again pushed out of the woods. But now things change. The Americans have so many troops that they are able to just come out of that wood line and chase the British down. The Royal Artillerymen, with their two pair of light six-pounders, they have no choice but to run away. They can't exactly easily drag off their cannons because the horses have been killed. As you can imagine, the first casualties of a battle like this are the horses, because they're the big ones. And people know that if you shoot the horses, it's going to be much harder to maneuver the cannons. It's like, you know, shooting the tires off of a car. It's not going to be easy to move that car, you know, a war car or whatever. Tanks, of course, you can't shoot the tires. But you know what I'm saying? It's the same concept. You shoot the tires, you can't maneuver very easily. So that's what the Americans had done, shoot the horses. The Americans, they capture... Whoops, okay. One of those holes that the archaeologists had dug, yes. So the Americans are able to capture a cannon, or a pair of cannons, rather. So there are three different examples that we have specific anecdotes about Americans capturing these guns during the course of the battle. At one point, the Americans tried to turn the gun on the British, the pair of guns, but the British were already coming back to retake the guns. The Americans had to retreat. The second time, the Americans tried to maneuver the guns around, but they couldn't shoot them because the British had run off with the linstocks, which are the things they use to fire the cannons. You can't fire the cannons. The third time, the Americans said, okay, we can't shoot the cannons apparently, but let's get the cannons out of here. So they got the cannons, the two pair of cannons, the ones right over there, for example, and they tried to drag them off the field. They tried to pull them off the field. They couldn't do it in time. The British were upon them almost instantaneously. So this battle was very much a vicious fight, back and forth, back and forth. As for Dearborn, he had his own problems to deal with. He had to fight over there on the other field adjacent to Freeman's Farm. It's not part of the Tor Road, but Simon Fraser's guys, remember over 2,000 of them over there? Well, Simon Fraser's guys go to fight Henry Dearborn. That's way over, you know, a good half a mile to the west of us. And then more reinforcements sent by Arnold to fight against Fraser. So almost a separate battle is going on to the west here of Freeman's Farm. It's all called the Battle of Freeman's Farm, but in truth, only most of the battle is fought on Freeman's Farm, not the entire thing. Cook's Battalion of Connecticut Militia. And during the course of the fighting, the Connecticut militia soldiers, you know, these guys had just come from their farms and their homes in Connecticut. They'd been called to serve in the Northern Army for 2 months, and now they're here on the front lines. Gotta remember, this is kind of crazy, but there are Continental regiments behind the lines that were never deployed in any Battle of Saratoga. Like, if you wanted to be safe and sound, you know, you'd want to be in, like, the 11th Massachusetts Regiment or the 15th Massachusetts Regiment. They're not, you know, they're not fighting in the battles, you know. But Connecticut militia, Arnold wanted them to go right in. He's from Connecticut. He must have had great expectations for his soldiers, and boy, did they fight fiercely when it comes down to it. Thaddeus Cook's Battalion of Connecticut Militia suffered the second highest casualty rate of all of the American regiments. They suffered about 60 casualties, mostly killed and wounded. 60 casualties. One of those who were a casualty was Captain Bidwell. This monument was put up by descendants of the family nearly 100 years ago now. And that monument commemorates his service and the fact that he was mortally wounded right near here in the Battle of Freeman's Farm. He was either shot by a musket ball in the leg or, according to one account, a cannonball took the bottom of his leg off. And the surgeons tried to amputate, and they brought him back to the hospital, but he bled out and died. So he's not buried here. He's buried actually at the hospital near Gates's headquarters, which is within our park boundaries. But this monument commemorates his service and the Connecticut militia, who are often forgotten in the histories of the battles of Saratoga.
Did the Connecticut militia, were they proud or happy to serve with Arnold? Sure. Him more than anyone else.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I can tell you that they weren't happy to be in the same brigade as the New York Continental troops. But yes, they were. Yeah, they were very, very happy to be under Arnold's division. Yes. Yeah. Sure. Oh, yes. The other side of the battlefield, so we got the core battlefield, you got the stuff going on between Fraser and American units that had been sent to fight him. But over in the field, do you remember I mentioned the 20th Regiment was down in the cultivated farm field? Well, they're just kind of hanging out, not literally, but, you know, they're not engaged in the main portion of the battle here, but they got their own problems. You remember the riflemen, of course. They had been scattered half a mile south of that tree line. And they were reforming their ranks. Finally, Colonel Morgan got them together again and decided that, either because he was told to or because he thought it was a good idea, either way, it was a good idea, to move through the woods over to the Americans' extreme right flank. So they're on the right of Cook's Battalion of Connecticut Militia. They put themselves in the woods, and according to one British Royal Artillery officer who was right here, 241 years ago, he wrote about it in his journal right after the fact. He said during the battle, they were, of course, fighting the Americans to their front, but they started getting shot at from the rear because of the riflemen in the woods. So the British are over here fighting the Americans in the woods, and the riflemen start shooting at the backs of the British. And the British came to realize, oh, what the heck, you know? So the 20th Regiment of Foot, 400 guys, were ordered to go into the woods and expel the riflemen, get rid of the riflemen out of those woods. Sounds easy enough, you know, going into the woods. We can't do it today. I don't recommend it because we do have a tick issue here at the park. There are deer ticks here which do carry Lyme disease. But if we had the opportunity, we can pretend, if you go into the woods, it's still there. Not too deep into the woods, there's an enormous and deep ravine. I kid you not. This thing is deeper than I am tall. This ravine is deep. So these guys in the 20th Regiment of Foot go into the woods, but they come to this ravine. They have to get into the ravine and get up the other side. Then there's a secondary ravine behind it. Behind that is abattis. Abattis is basically felled tree limbs that have been cut down by the riflemen, you can imagine, and put out with the upward branches facing toward the attacking enemy. So if you were able to get through both ravines, which I don't know if anybody actually did, but then you'd have to bust through the abattis, all those tree branches, and then finally go toe-to-toe with the riflemen who are, you know, probably a good, 100 yards away shooting at you from the woods. So, you know, from the trees. So, you know, it's not good for these guys in the 20th Regiment of Foot. They were just obliterated. They were beaten out of the woods pretty easily because they're suffering casualties. They can't even close with the riflemen. They can't even do it, yet they're being shot at. By the end of the battle, they receive 110 casualties. That's over 25% of their numbers, and they never even got to the riflemen. They couldn't touch them during the entire battle. The riflemen completely immune to attack from the 20th Regiment of Foot, yet the 20th Regiment suffered 25 casualties, over 100 officers and men. They were just beaten severely. They couldn't get at the riflemen. So as the day wears on, it's getting, you know, kind of like this, I guess, you know, dark, you know, a little breezy perhaps, too breezy maybe, not for them. I'm sure they're building up a sweat, and it's in a battle situation. You know, it's terrifying, of course, especially when we think of most of these British soldiers, most of them, a majority of them, had never fought in a battle their whole lives. These were not veteran soldiers. These were not guys who were used to fighting in wars, and they're, you know, automaton, you know, they know how to do everything a soldier can do with their eyes blindfolded. And you know, they are fearless. That's not these guys at all. These guys are green soldiers. Most of them, their officers included, had never fought in a battle before. For the Americans, it's very much the opposite. Most of the Americans had seen combat before. While the American units were relatively newly formed, militia, you know, they were formed their ranks just a month earlier. As for the Continental regiments, most of those were raised in late 1776, early 1777. The people themselves had served in previous campaigns and in battles like Bunker Hill, for example, or Princeton or Trenton, Lexington and Concord, the attack on Quebec City, etc., etc. Long Island, you know, you name it. Harlem Heights, White Plains. So they had combat experience under their belts, whereas most of the British did not, which is kind of opposite of what we usually think, right? The British are the veterans, the Americans are the country bumpkins that don't know what they're doing. Just the opposite here at Saratoga, which of course is in our favor. So the battle is raging on. The Americans have every advantage in numbers, experience. The British are being spent. The British aren't getting reinforcements. They can't turn the riflemen out. The battle is going on over there. It's kind of a stalemate in the other field. The Americans are pushing very, very aggressively out onto the field. The British are retreating toward the end of the day. Looks like the Americans are going to win this fight, but that's not what happens. The British win, and they only win because of one thing, one trick, one thing that happens. The same thing, by the way, that happened in the Battle of Hubbardton. Does anybody know what that is?
Call the Germans along the river to come to his aid.
That's right. I heard singing Germans, too. That's right. Yes. Singing Germans. Yeah. So remember those guys by the river, the column, mostly Germans? You know, they're just guarding the supplies and the people, the civilians. They're not really looking to battle anybody. They're just guarding. And so finally, General Burgoyne decides he needs help. You know, he should have sent it hours before, but Burgoyne thinks he can take care of things himself, especially since he's commanding his red-coated soldiers. And so far in this campaign, he's berated Germans a lot, and he likes to keep with that theme, perhaps. But now he realizes that, okay, I need help. I need Germans. So the messenger finally gets to the German commander down by the river, General Riedesel. And General Riedesel, who has already staged a reinforcement, because he's been hearing this firing going on all day in basically the same area, so he's thinking, yeah, okay, I'm going to anticipate a request for reinforcements, and that's exactly what happens. General Riedesel immediately acts once he gets that order, and 700 German infantry are sent in from the river. They go up right along a road, which is the Wilkinson Trail today, if you've taken the Wilkinson Trail. It's the same roadbed. They come spilling out of the southeastern corner of that portion of the farm field. Two light six-pounders, remember those guns over there? Two light six-pounders are brought up on that hill right over there, the hill where we started our tour, because the Americans were really pushing forth. And they opened up with these six-pounders. The other British six-pounders had been silenced. You know, they're not being used because the British can't get to them anymore. And the German infantry, the 700 guys, immediately right into the woods. And they're going to not try to go at the rifleman's front, but because they're coming in from the east, they're going to then strike at the rifleman's flank. The riflemen see this attack developing. They fold like a house of cards. They don't even try to stop it because it's getting late in the day. And the Americans are running out of ammunition. Remember I said that the British, the Germans too, they had 100 rounds of ammunition on their person or in their knapsacks piled up behind them, which they can get more ammunition if they have to out of their knapsacks. The Americans are going into battle with anywhere from 24 to 30 rounds of ammunition. That's it. The Americans run out of ammunition a lot faster than the British do. So ammunition for the Americans is at a premium. The Germans now are going through the woods. The riflemen fold. The Cook's battalion of Connecticut militia had already retreated because of the high casualties they sustained. They got out of the fight. And the New Hampshire line also folds. The entire American line collapses thanks to this German reinforcement. It's very interesting to see how the British win various battles in this campaign. Hubbardton, German reinforcement saves the day. Fort Anne, an Indian reinforcement saves the day for the British. Here you have the Battle of Freeman's Farm. German reinforcement saves the day for the British. The British, you know, they can do so much, but they just can't win, you know, unless they get this last-minute reinforcement that comes to save the day for them. So the battle is over. The Battle of Freeman's Farm, like I said, between 7:30, their time, of course. We have daylight savings time we're contending with, so we're an hour ahead of what their time would have been. But the Americans say in their letters, you know, their reports about it, that they retreated because they were being, you know, outflanked by this new reinforcement and because they ran out of ammunition. They specifically cite it. The want of ammunition, they say. They had to retreat. They had no choice. And Arnold, he had sent every single regiment that he could to the field of battle. He ended up sending half the entire American army. He couldn't send any more because he only commands half the army. and that's the half that was sent to the battle. So he had played all his cards, and it was brilliant. He stopped the British advance. So the Battle of Freeman's Farm was, although a tactical British victory, it was a strategic American win. The British hold the field of battle. And that's how you gauge who wins a battle, technically, right? Who holds the field of battle? That's your tactical victory. Even if it's a Pyrrhic one. You know, like Bunker Hill, the British win the battle, they hold the field, but they suffered a lot more casualties. The British ended up suffering about 580 casualties, killed, captured, wounded, of which about 400 of them were captured. So imagine, therefore, about 540, mostly British, some Germans, but mostly British soldiers and officers killed and wounded right through here and in the woods, right around us. They're still buried out here, most of them, I should add. Indeed, this is a cemetery with unmarked graves, but it is a cemetery. The Americans suffered 320 killed, captured, and wounded, of which about 20 of them had been captured. So about 300 of the Americans were killed and wounded, again, on the same field as well as in the woods. And indeed, likewise, most of them are still buried out here after the battle. So casualties are very different between the two sides. The British are the ones that suffered the most, but they won the Battle of Freeman's Farm. Now, that is the end of the battle, but I'll just tell you very briefly, I promise, what happened after that. After the battle's fought, Burgoyne thanks his troops, you know, through general orders. Good job, everybody. Oh, except Redcoats, British, I want you to use the national weapon more in the next fight, the bayonet. He says that they relied too much on their shooting and not enough on the bayonet, which I think is rather prevalent of rather green soldiers, right? You're going to rely on shooting more than going in with the bayonet, makes sense to me. Plus, Burgoyne was admonishing his British soldiers for not closing in the woods with the bayonet more and relying on shooting from trees when they're being massed, you know, the enemy's being massed against them. As for Benedict Arnold, he put out a divisional order to his troops, thanking their fighting in the Battle of Freeman's Farm, saying, you guys did great, but he also had an admonishment too. He says that from this point on, because we have suffered so many officer casualties, officers should no longer lead their men from the front, but rather take up their proper places in the line. You see, the little truth is, and this isn't usually something that comes out in most histories on the battles of Saratoga, except mine, the point is that the American officer corps actually suffered greater casualties than the British officer corps did. Shockingly, but true. Not in numbers. The British officer corps suffered 5 more officer casualties than the Americans. But when you count rank, the Americans suffered way higher casualties. The highest-ranking British officer killed or mortally wounded was a captain. The highest-ranking American officer killed or mortally wounded was a lieutenant colonel, and there were 2 of them, both of the Continental Line. The American officer corps command was really, really hit hard compared to the British officer corps command. General Burgoyne had a few narrow escapes himself. You know, he's on horseback way over there on the northern side of the field where it's not exactly safe and sound. But, you know, he was shot at. One of the aides-de-camp on horse was shot in the arm, so he's wounded, didn't die. But, you know, they're going to be susceptible to firings, too. As for Benedict Arnold, he's safe. He directed things from afar. He was never on the field directing things personally, but he was in the woods riding back and forth between the various fields, making sure things were going the way that they should be going. So, in the end, the battle, British victory, American strategic victory, British tactical victory. But after that battle, that's when General Burgoyne gets a little secret message from the commander in New York City, Sir Henry Clinton. Sir Henry Clinton tells Burgoyne that Clinton is going to make a diversion in the Hudson Highlands, making it easier for Burgoyne to get to Albany. Burgoyne responds, "Do it, my friend, directly." That's a quote. "Do it, my friend, directly." Burgoyne then decides to stay put, build up fortifications. These white and red posts show you where the outlines were. Set up camp and wait for Clinton's diversion to have an effect. So he never followed up immediately on this victory in the Battle of Freeman's Farm. He's waiting for assistance to come from the city of New York. And on the 7th of October, I'll pick up the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
thank you. It's a bit chilly, I think. I'm loving it. I'm all excited. But today, on this day, the anniversary, 241 years plus, of the Second Battle of Saratoga, also called the Battle of Bemis's Heights. If we were here exactly at this time, 241 years ago, you would have been hearing shots right now, right here at this very field, because the battle was in the midst of starting. We know it started at about this time, daylight savings time considered. So, you know, it's kind of cool to be here at this moment, again, 241 years ago in the future. And at a place that's so important, the Second Battle of Saratoga, like I mentioned earlier, is one of those many, many, many battles in the Revolutionary War that had major consequences. Some battles that were fought, you know, they happened. They're important for the sake of the battle itself, and of course the people involved in those battles. Sometimes they're, you know, if they're dead, if they're severely wounded, if they have seen the horrors of war, those battles on a personal level are terrifying and terrible. And if you're dead, of course, it puts a period to your life. But in other cases, other battles are.